All right, strap in, everyone. Today we are going deep on a case that really stirred things up.
Oh, yeah, this one's a biggie.
Yeah, Joe Hogan versus Mississippi University for Women, MUW for short. We've got a whole pile of legal docs and analyses. And let me tell you, this isn't just some boring history lesson.
Nope, not at all.
This gets right to the heart of some really big questions that, honestly, we're still wrestling with today.
Absolutely, and that's what makes this case so fascinating, you know? It forces us to confront some really tough issues about individual rights and societal norms.
Yeah, like where's the line?
Exactly, and how does the government play a role in all of this? Not just a legal puzzle, it reflects a whole society trying to figure out, like, evolving ideas about gender and opportunity.
Totally. So, picture this. You're a qualified male nurse.
Okay.
Your name is Joe Hogan, living in Mississippi back in the late 1970s.
Yeah.
You want to get your bachelor's in nursing, right?
Makes sense.
But the closest program that will actually accept you is miles away.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, MUW, with a nursing school right there in your backyard, they've got this women-only admissions policy.
Oh, wow.
So what do you do?
Well, in this case, Hogan decided, I'm going to fight back. He filed a lawsuit claiming that MUW's policy violated his right to equal protection.
Under the law.
Yeah, as guaranteed by the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
It's this clash between individual rights and, you know, institutional policies that makes this case so interesting.
Yeah, for sure. So we've got a man who wants to go to nursing school in a university with this long tradition of only admitting women. What happened next? Did the courts just say, well, that's tradition, case closed?
Well, not quite. It actually gets kind of interesting here. The lower courts actually couldn't agree on this one.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The district court actually sided with MUW.
Okay.
They said the policy was reasonable, you know, rationally related to promoting those educational opportunities for women.
Right.
But the Court of Appeals, they took a different stance. They argued that the state needed a much stronger justification to be able to exclude men.
Ah, so that's how this ended up in the Supreme Court's hands. A classic case of lower courts disagreeing, sending it up the chain.
Exactly. You got it. The Supreme Court had to step in and decide whose interpretation of the Equal Protection Clause was actually right.
Huge.
Yeah. Was this policy a legit way to support women's education, or was it discrimination? And if so, was it outdated and violated men's rights?
Such a big decision. And spoiler alert, the court ruled in favor of Joe Hogan. They said that MUW's single-sex admissions policy for the nursing school was unconstitutional. But before we go and celebrate Hogan's win, let's break down why the court decided that. Because the reasoning, it's just as important as the outcome, right?
Oh, absolutely. The court didn't just use a simple rational basis test. They used something called intermediate scrutiny.
Ooh, fancy.
Which is a much tougher standard when you're dealing with classifications based on gender. So Mississippi had to prove that their policy, you know, it wasn't just reasonable. It served a really important goal.
Important governmental objective.
Exactly. And that it was substantially related to achieving that goal. Like, they had to have a really good reason for excluding men.
Okay, so the bar was set pretty high. What arguments did Mississippi use to defend their policy? Did they manage to clear that high bar?
Well, their main argument was that this policy was a form of affirmative action designed to kind of compensate for past discrimination against women in nursing. They were like, look, women have historically been disadvantaged in this field, so we're trying to level the playing field here.
Okay, trying to make things right.
But the court wasn't buying it.
Not really, no.
So what? Was the court saying that past discrimination didn't matter?
No, not at all. They pointed out that the situation in nursing was actually the opposite of what Mississippi was suggesting.
What do you mean? Women weren't underrepresented in nursing. They were the dominant force. In fact, the stats showed that the year before MUW's nursing school even opened, women earned over 90% of nursing degrees.
Wow.
Both in Mississippi and nationwide.
So the state was trying to fix a problem that didn't even exist?
Yeah.
That seems a little backwards.
It does, doesn't it? And the court saw it that way, too. They said that instead of helping women, this policy was actually reinforcing those harmful stereotypes about nursing being, you know, women's work. It's like saying, well, women are already good at this, so let's just keep it that way, which isn't exactly progress.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
So the state's main argument, it kind of backfired.
Yeah, you could say that.
They ended up reinforcing the stereotype they said they were fighting against.
Yeah, and it gets worse. Their troubles didn't end there. The court pointed out something else that really hurt Mississippi's case. MUW allowed men to audit nursing classes.
Oh, interesting.
So if having men in the classroom was so bad for women's education as they claimed, why let them in at all, even just to watch?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's like their actions were totally contradicting their own argument. If they really believed that a single-sex learning environment was so important, they wouldn't let men in at all.
Exactly. The court saw this as a major inconsistency. Plus, there was nothing to show that letting men sit in on classes hurt the women or changed how they were taught.
Okay, so their reasoning was flawed. Their actions didn't back up their claims. Sounds like their defense was falling apart pretty quickly. Did they have any other arguments? Anything else up their sleeve?
Well, they tried one more thing. They brought up Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. There's a part in Title IX that says public undergrad schools that have always been single sex are exempt from the rule against gender discrimination.
So they were basically saying, hey, Congress gave us a free pass on this one.
Pretty much.
We're good.
Yeah. They argued that Congress, when they passed Title IX, actually limited the 14th Amendment, gave them the okay to keep their single sex policy.
Interesting tactic. But the court didn't buy this one either.
Nope, not at all.
Why not? Did they think Congress was wrong to put that exemption in Title IX?
Well, the court emphasized a super important legal principle. Congress can't just say it's okay for states to violate the Constitution, even if Congress thinks it's helping the goals of the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, that makes sense. It'd be chaos if Congress could just pick and choose which parts of the Constitution they wanted to enforce.
Exactly. The court was sending a message like, the Constitution is the top dog here. States can't just ignore its protections, even if they've got some law that seems to give them a pass.
So that shuts down the state's arguments. But before we move on, I want to zoom out a little.
Okay.
We've been focused on all the legal stuff. But this wasn't happening in a bubble. This was the late 1970s.
Right.
A time of big changes, especially about gender roles.
Huge cultural shifts. You can't understand this case without thinking about that.
The women's rights movement was gaining momentum, and the Equal Rights Amendment, even though it didn't pass, was a big debate. This case landed right in the middle of all of that.
Right in the thick of it.
So the court's decision, it wasn't just about Joe Hogan wanting to go to nursing school. It reflected a whole society trying to figure out what equality really means.
What it means to be equal, absolutely.
About how men and women's roles were changing.
And how the law should change with them.
Exactly, yeah. And that's what makes this case so relevant, even today. It's not just a history lesson. It shows a really important moment in our journey toward more equality and justice.
Yeah, for sure.
Wow, this is already getting me thinking. But we've only scratched the surface here. I want to dig into those dissenting opinions and, you know, really explore what this case means in the big picture.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there.
But we'll have to save that for the next part of your deep dive.
So, you know, picking up where we left off, I think the court really put its foot down when it rejected Mississippi's Title IX argument.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
It underlined this idea that, sure, Congress can pass laws to help enforce the 14th Amendment.
Right.
But they can't actually shrink those constitutional guarantees.
So even though Title IX had that exemption, it couldn't trump the Constitution. Like, the Constitution is the ultimate rule book.
Yeah.
And even Congress has to follow it.
Exactly. The Constitution, and especially how the Supreme Court interprets it, is like the highest authority in the land. And this case is a perfect example of how the courts, the judiciary, act as this safeguard. They make sure individual rights aren't being trampled on, even when those rights clash with, you know, old practices or what seem like loopholes in laws.
Right, right. It's a good reminder that the Constitution's not just some old document, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It still has teeth, still shapes our laws and our lives in very real ways. But okay, let's switch gears a bit and talk about those dissenting opinions. I'm always fascinated by the judges who disagree with the majority.
Me too.
It really shows you how complex an issue can be.
Oh, absolutely. Dissenting opinions are so valuable. They make you see things from different angles, and they make you think about the potential consequences of a ruling. In this case, you know, the dissents offer some really insightful counterpoints. They really enrich how we understand the whole debate about single-sex education.
Okay, so you mentioned Chief Justice Berger earlier. He seemed to think that the ruling should only apply to professional schools, like nursing. What was his logic there?
Well, Berger was worried that the court focused too much on the fact that at that time there were already more women than men in nursing.
Okay, yeah.
And he argued that this wouldn't necessarily make sense in other fields where women might still face big obstacles.
So he's saying that, yes, it's wrong to exclude men from a nursing school.
Right.
But a similar policy might be okay in a field where women have historically been underrepresented, like a temporary thing to level the playing field.
That was his main point, yeah. He wasn't saying discrimination is ever good, but he was suggesting that sometimes single-sex programs could help promote gender equality.
It's a tough argument. You want to make sure everyone has the same opportunities. But you also don't want to create new kinds of exclusion. What about the other dissenting opinions? You said Justice Blackmun was worried about all single-sex education disappearing.
Yeah, he was really concerned about preserving diversity in education. He thought the court's decision might be, like, interpreted too broadly, leading to everyone being forced into the same mold. And that could actually stifle creativity, limit choices for students.
So he agreed that keeping men out of MUW's nursing school was wrong.
Right.
But he didn't want to see all female or all male schools go away entirely. It was about having options, different ways of learning.
Exactly. Blackmun saw value in different educational approaches, including those that focus on one gender, as long as they're not being used to, reinforce bad stereotypes or deny opportunities. He thought getting rid of single-sex education altogether could actually harm students who do well in those environments.
Mm, that's interesting. It raises the question of what equality really means. Is it about forcing everyone into the same system? Or is it about making sure everyone has the same opportunities? Regardless of gender or background, can you have both individual choice and a commitment to, breaking down those systemic barriers?
Yeah, those are the big questions this case brings up, and there aren't any easy answers. Now, Justice Powell, he wrote the last dissenting opinion, and Justice Rehnquist agreed with him. They took a slightly different approach. They focused more on individual choice and the potential good things about single-sex education, especially for women.
Yeah, you mentioned Powell pointing out that no women joined Hogan's lawsuit. It seemed like he was implying that this meant many women actually liked the single-sex environment at MUW.
Yeah, exactly. He argued that MUW wasn't limiting women's opportunities. It was actually giving them more choices, a different option from the mostly co-ed system.
So he was saying true equality means being able to choose between different kinds of education, even if some of those are based on gender, like having a diverse educational landscape is a good thing.
Yeah, he believed in letting individuals pick the learning environment that works best for them, even if those preferences are, influenced by societal norms or whatever.
Yeah.
He didn't see single-sex education as bad in itself, as long as it was a choice, not something forced on you.
I see. It suggests that maybe we shouldn't focus on getting rid of all differences, but making sure everyone has equal access to a bunch of options.
And letting them make informed choices.
Right. So we have all these different opinions, right? The majority opinion that struck down MUW's policy.
Right.
And these three dissenting opinions, each raising important points, different ways of looking at it.
It shows you that even in cases that seem pretty clear-cut, there's often a lot more going on beneath the surface. You have to think about different values, potential consequences, and sometimes even policies that are meant to do good can have downsides you didn't expect.
Yeah, and those dissenting opinions often spark the most interesting discussions.
Oh.
They make us think about the nuances, the long-term implications, the whole picture.
Absolutely. And they remind us that the law isn't set in stone, It's always changing, being reinterpreted. As social norms change, as we learn new things, as our understanding of rights evolves.
You're right. You're right. And this case, with its clashing views and unanswered questions, really captures that. It's a glimpse of a society in transition, trying to grapple with these really complex issues that still challenge us today. This case is like opening a can of worms, in terms of the questions it raises about gender equality and how education shapes our society.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing how a case about one guy wanting to go to nursing school can open up so many bigger issues.
It really shows you how intertwined everything is. Our laws, our society, our culture. It highlights how important it is to approach these topics carefully, think critically, and be willing to listen to different perspectives.
I'm starting to see this not just as a legal battle,
yeah,
but as like a tiny version of the bigger struggle for gender equality. We're still dealing with many of the same questions this case brought up. How do we achieve real equality without taking away individual choice? How do we get rid of harmful stereotypes without erasing actual differences?
Big questions.
What does it really mean to create an education system that's truly fair and inclusive?
You hit it right on the head. This case is a reminder that the fight for equality is a journey, not a destination.
It's ongoing.
Yeah, we have to constantly be paying attention, thinking critically, challenging our own assumptions, and being open to viewpoints that are different from our own.
Well said. Okay, so we've looked at the historical context,
yeah,
the legal back and forth, and those fascinating dissenting opinions.
A lot of ground covered.
But before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I think we should go back to the specific reasons why the court said MUW's policy was unconstitutional.
You know,
just to refresh our memories.
Yeah, good point. It's easy to get lost in the big ideas. But the actual legal logic behind the court's decision, that's what really matters in the long run. So remember, the court used intermediate scrutiny in this case.
Right, right. But remind me again, what does that actually mean? And why is it so important?
So basically, it means the government has to show a strong link between treating men and women differently and an important goal they're trying to achieve.
Okay, so it's not enough to just say, hey, we have a reason for treating men and women differently.
Nope.
They had to prove that what they're doing actually works to reach that goal.
Show me the receipts, basically.
Exactly. And in this case, the court said Mississippi didn't do that. They couldn't show that keeping men out of the nursing school was really necessary or even helpful in achieving their goal of, you know, making up for past discrimination. Okay, let's unpack that a little more. What exactly did the court find missing in the state's argument?
Well, first off, they didn't buy the state's claim that the policy was a form of affirmative action. As we've discussed, the evidence just didn't support that.
Yeah.
Women were already doing great in nursing, both in school and in jobs.
Right, right. Those statistics we talked about. Hard to argue that women were being held back when they were already the majority.
Exactly. The court thought the state's argument was more likely to reinforce the stereotype of nursing as women's work than actually fix any historical disadvantages. It's like they were accidentally making the problem worse.
Yeah, it's like they were arguing against themselves, unintentionally supporting the very bias they said they were fighting.
It does seem that way. But even if we, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt and say they really believe their policy was trying to compensate for the past, the court said it still failed the second part of the equal protection test.
The part about the method being substantially related to the goal.
Yes. So even if their intentions were good, the way they were going about it wasn't actually effective. And this is where that whole men auditing classes thing comes back in.
Right. The court saw that as a big problem for the state's case. If having men around was so bad for women's education, like they said, why let them in at all?
Right. Good point. Like, their actions contradicted what they were saying. If they were serious about needing a single-sex environment, they wouldn't have made exceptions.
Exactly. And there was nothing to show that letting men into those nursing classes made the teaching worse or hurt how well the women did. There was just no proof that keeping men out was necessary to, you know, protect or improve women's education. They couldn't show a clear connection between their policy and what they wanted to achieve.
So it wasn't just that their goal was questionable, but the way they went about it didn't hold up either. They couldn't prove their policy was doing what they said it was doing.
You got it. Their arguments were weak on both sides, the goal and the method. And the court saw right through that. They really examined each of the state's arguments, pointed out the problems, and ultimately decided that the policy didn't have that exceedingly persuasive justification that you need to justify treating people differently based on gender.
It's like watching a legal battle play out. Each side trying to make their move counter the other's arguments.
A chess match.
Exactly. And in this match, the court sided with Hogan, saying the state's arguments just couldn't stand up to that tough intermediate scrutiny standard.
Mm.
Their logic didn't work, and their evidence wasn't strong enough. This has been so eye-opening, this whole deep dive. We've covered the historical stuff, the legal arguments back and forth, all those different opinions. I'm really starting to understand how complicated this case was. But now I'm even more curious about the bigger picture. What happened to other single-sex schools? How did this decision change the whole debate about gender equality in education?
Those are the key questions. The impact of this decision went way beyond Joe Hogan and MUW. It had a ripple effect, touching on these fundamental questions about how gender plays a role in education, the limits of what the government can do, and this ongoing struggle to create a truly fair and equal society.
Okay, I'm all ears. Let's talk about those bigger implications and how this case still shapes the conversation today. This is where things get really interesting. So we've really dissected the Hogan case, but I'm curious about the fallout, you know.
The aftershocks.
Yeah, exactly. How did this decision affect other single-sex schools? Did it basically kill the whole idea, or was there still some room to maneuver?
That's the million-dollar question, right? And it gets to the heart of the case's legacy. Hogan versus Mississippi University for Women. It definitely made things tougher for publicly funded single-sex education, no doubt. But it didn't totally shut it down.
So not a complete ban, more like a proceed with caution sign for any school thinking about keeping or starting a single-sex program.
That's a pretty good way to put it. The court basically said, if you're going to have a publicly funded program, especially at a university, and it's single-sex, you better have a darn good reason. And that reason can't be, like, some old stereotype about what men and women are supposed to be good at.
So the bar got raised, huh? You can't just rely on tradition or separate but equal anymore.
Nope.
You've got to prove there's a real need, a compelling one, and that excluding one gender is absolutely crucial to meeting that need.
Exactly. And that shift, that change in perspective, was huge. It really shook things up in the education world. Schools had to reevaluate their single-sex programs, and it became way harder to justify new ones.
Like a wake-up call.
Yeah, for sure. Accountability and scrutiny got a lot more serious.
So it kind of forced this national conversation. People had to really think about what single-sex education was all about, and whether it still fit in a society that was trying to achieve gender equality.
Absolutely. The Hogan case became a rallying point for anyone who supported equal opportunities in education. They had this powerful legal tool to challenge policies that were unfair and push for more inclusion, more access for all students, regardless of gender.
It's incredible how one case, you know, starting with just one person's issue, can have such a big impact. It affects not just the people involved, but the whole system, and even future legal cases. Yeah, that's the power of precedent in our legal system. Hogan sent a clear message. Gender discrimination in public education just won't fly.
Like they drew a line in the sand.
Yeah.
This far and no further.
Exactly. But, and here's the interesting part, where exactly is that line? What kinds of single-sex programs, if any, could still be okay after Hogan?
Yeah, good question.
It's where things get really tricky. Hogan definitely limited what was acceptable, but it didn't give a precise list. It's more about how strong your justification is and the proof you've got to back it up.
So it's not about the specific program itself, but the reason behind it.
Right.
You got to convince the court that there's a really good reason for excluding one gender and that what you're doing is directly tied to that goal.
Exactly. For example, the court mentioned that programs that are trying to fix past discrimination against women in certain fields, those might still be okay. Like, let's say there's clear evidence that women have been kept out of a specific STEM field. A program specifically aimed at addressing that, creating opportunities for women in that field, that might be considered justifiable.
So it's all about being specific.
Yeah.
You can't just say, oh, girls are bad at math, so let's have a girls-only math program.
Right, right.
You have to show a real problem with real evidence, and the program has to be designed to solve that problem. No relying on tired old stereotypes.
Absolutely. And even then, it's an uphill battle. The burden of proof is high, and anyone who wants to have a single-sex program has to make a very, very strong case. Show not only a real need, but also that there's no other way, no less discriminatory way, to achieve their goals.
So Evigan didn't completely wipe out single-sex education, but it definitely brought in this era of, like, really close scrutiny. People had to think more carefully about the purpose and effectiveness of these programs. It's like single-sex education had this free-for-all, and then a new sheriff came to town.
I love that analogy, and that's a major point. It wasn't just about the legal side of things. It really sparked this national debate about gender in education, you know, the pros and cons of different models, and how to actually achieve true equality.
A debate that's still going on. We're still asking those same questions. How do you balance equal opportunity with letting people choose what they want?
Mm.
How do you fix past injustices without creating new types of exclusion?
Right.
What does a truly fair and inclusive education system actually look like?
Yeah, all those big questions. And Hogan reminds us that anytime you're treating people differently based on gender, you have to be really careful. It doesn't matter how good your intentions are. It's not enough to just rely on tradition or what you think you know. We need evidence, data, and a real understanding of how gender, equality, and opportunity all work together.
This whole deep dive has been so insightful. We've covered the history, the legal arguments, the different opinions, and the impact of this landmark case. But before we wrap up completely, I want to leave our listeners with something to think about, a question that takes us beyond this case and keeps the conversation going.
I like that, a little food for thought.
So here it is. If Hogan said that publicly funded single-sex education is basically assumed to be unconstitutional, should that same standard apply to private schools too? Where's the line between the government making sure things are equal and private organizations having the freedom to set their own rules? It's a question that gets to the heart of, you know, how much power the government should have in our lives.
Wow, that's a great question. And a tough one, too. It makes you think about where the government's authority ends and how we balance individual freedom with what's good for society as a whole. Does the Constitution apply to private choices, or should people and groups be free to decide for themselves? There are really good arguments on both sides, and it's a debate that's still happening in courts and classrooms all over the country.
It reminds us that even when there's a clear legal decision, like in Hogan, there are still deeper questions that haven't been fully answered. We have to keep talking about them, thinking about the nuances, and considering how our legal and social norms are constantly changing. It's not about finding easy answers, it's about having thoughtful conversations, being informed, and wrestling with the hard stuff as we try to build a fairer, more just world.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Well, on that note, we'll wrap up our deep dive into Hogan versus Mississippi University for Women. We've looked at legal precedents, social change, and the fight for a fairer world, a journey with wins and challenges still ahead.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, everyone. We hope this sparked some curiosity, gave you new insights, and inspired you to keep thinking about these important, complex issues that are always evolving.
We'll see you next time for another deep dive into the ideas and events that shape our world. Until then, keep those critical thinking skills sharp and keep those conversations going.